Potting's winning.
Ing is winning. So, it's election night.
Oh, I hadn't heard.
Yeah. So there's that.
Are we getting a new offensive coordinator?
I don't think he was on the ballot.
Nepotism.
They've kept him off the ballot. Those sons of bitches.
How deep does this go?
Let's ignore politics.
Please. Yes.
And let's talk about the other thing that divides Iowans, Kirk Ferentz. Iowa runs out victorious, comically victorious, frankly, in West Lafayette. Final score 24-3. And while the plaudits deservedly should go to the defense for holding a Purdue offense that had given up or that had scored at least 20 points in something like 17 straight games to just three, the story, of course, is the Iowa offense.
Unstoppable. A Goliath, a juggernaut.
A real face. Juggernaut, I was going to say, yes. It contains multitudes.
There's nothing they can't do.
There's really
stopped.
At this point, the only thing they can't do is punt the ball away.
Taylor granted all his powers to the offense.
Iowa gets 192 yards passing for Spencer Petras on a respectable 13 of 23. Not great, but respectable. Couple of touchdown passes. Given where we've been, it was as if Dan Marino entered the building.
And not all those incompletions were on him. We'll put it that way.
No, that's certainly true. More importantly, 22 carries for 200 yards from newly anointed bell cow Caleb Johnson. That's 9.1 yards a carry if you're just tuning in. A lot of those on a 75 yard roughly.
Yep.
Touchdown run early in the third quarter that capped all scoring in the game, and then Iowa decided, well, we're good here. We're not giving up three touchdowns to Aiden O'Connell and Charlie Jones. It's clear that Purdue did what Purdue always does against Iowa, which is pick their best receiver, use Iowa's right cornerback, left quarterback thing as to their advantage to get him the favorable matchup, and then just try to throw up the ball as many times as possible. That did not work because Iowa secondary is just simply too good this year. It was staggering to me that noted Iowa killer Jeff Brohm, who has made a career now out of targeting Riley Moss, still targeted Riley Moss despite the fact that Riley Moss is now an All-American cornerback, just to avoid having to throw the ball at erstwhile QB1 Cooper DeJean.
Cooper DeJean. Colonel Mustard.
Colonel Mustard, as we call him. And while I laugh and agree with that general premise, it seems like they probably need a better game plan than that. While Moss does not have his gaudy interception numbers this year, he's been arguably a better defensive back than he was the previous season. And that was Charlie Jones is not of the level of Rondale Moore or the other Purdue receivers who have tormented us in the past as well. And those two things combined meant that was just not going to work. And there didn't seem to be a plan B. The win certainly seemed to help Iowa. Both teams really didn't seem to have too much trouble working with the wind as it was, but especially in the second half when the wind kind of picked up a little bit and Iowa had a decided advantage, it certainly worked in their favor. I mean, Purdue was basically unable to convert with the wind at their back in the third. And that was effectively the end of the ballgame.
It's really remarkable that having the wind ended up being some sort of a curse for both offenses. Iowa scored all their points into that wind over the course of the game. And Aiden O'Connell's two interceptions were both ones that, you know, just so happened to sail on him. And, you know, they weren't great throws to begin with, and usually they were under pressure. And, boy, he did not have a fun time on Saturday whatsoever. But being able to throw into that wind didn't help him one bit. So that was interesting to see, because we've seen plenty of instances where that hasn't been the case. You know, the first and obviously most notable one that comes to mind is Trick or Treat Iowa City, Iowa versus Indiana.
Indeed.
The Tyler Sash game. Yeah.
They're all Tyler Sash games in that year, but yes, I agree.
Right. So that was an unexpected part of that. Obviously, Caleb Johnson, 200 yards. And really, like, take away the 75-yarder, which point of contention wasn't roughly 75. It was precisely 75 because
well, I'm glad my recollection is right then. That's good. I just want to – I have to fudge those things. I'm not looking at the actual numbers. So that's good.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was a touchback, and Petrus's first play was an incomplete pass. So it couldn't have been more 75 yards,
there you go.
Patrick. Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, you're relying on Big Ten refs to get the spot right, and I'm not willing to do that.
That's true. It might have been on the 27 for all we know. But even taking that away, which, like, obviously, oh, if you take away the good things, it's worse. But even, like, even outside of that, that's still a 21-carry, 125-yard performance. And we would have taken that easily.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, yeah, it's
I think it's encouraging as well that they actually they basically put the offense just on him. Now, Gavin Williams being out certainly didn't it made it easier for them. But well, Sean Williams, who's been a pretty effective back in spots, got one carry for 2 yards. Patterson got four carries, I think, all late in the game after the stuff was basically the score was effectively settled. This was Iowa going with a freshman halfback who had the hot hand and who appears to have a level of vision and patience that we haven't seen in a while from an Iowa back, certainly since, you know, probably Akron Wadley, I would guess. I mean, I heard Tavian Banks comparisons, which, you know, let's pump the brakes a little bit on that. But
I wish. I'm not sure that's very apt, though.
Yeah.
Like, Tavian had a very distinct running style that had a lot to do with his soccer background that, I mean, you just don't see a whole lot from a lot of guys. I've seen Melvin Gordon as a comp. I've seen Tony Pollard. Now, obviously, style is one thing. Production and greatness is another. But, you know, he showed a few moves and showed a few things and has shown a few things all season that can't really be taught. And, you know, if you think about the Iowa backs who have that, like, well, you can't teach that type of talent, you know, you're thinking of Akram Wadley, you're thinking of Sean Green, who, you know, was another one of those guys where he's making moves that no defender would expect him to make. And we absolutely saw that on that 75-yard run where, you know, 95% of running backs would have bounced that to the outside, and for good reason. And that's sort of like what you'd be coached to do. But when Caleb Johnson goes inside, one, the defenders aren't expecting it. Two, he did have more space there. Like, he had the leverage to do it. And then once his physical gifts take over and he just hits that last gear, forget about it. Like, it wasn't difficult as soon as he made that linebacker miss.
Yeah.
And that was really something to see.
You're right. And the fact that he had the wherewithal to keep it on the inside or to tuck it back inside to avoid, you know, essentially running into the safety to the perimeter. Again, there's vision there that we don't see very often. There's patience there that's absolutely necessary for the system that Iowa runs.
And he's a true freshman.
He's a true freshman. And I get this. I get the sense that, you know, often we get halfbacks in who are completely capable, but never fully understand how to pick the cut on the outside zone or how to pick the hole on the inside zone. And some guys just naturally get it. And it in looking at the three backs that they've used primarily this year, he's the only one that I look at and say, well, that guy just seems to know where to go without, you know, running himself into a, you know, three tackle issue.
Here's how good that game was. Kirk Ferentz, who doesn't even take depth charts seriously, has already made him number one with a bullet on the depth chart coming into this week. Like, that was quick.
Yes. Yes. Which, I mean, like, I mean, we talked about him in, what, week two? Like, it's been evident this year that he's the best guy in, at least in game scenarios. And I understand, I mean, this is Kirk at his finest. You're never going to make a move off of one game. And you're always going to defer to the upperclassman or the more experienced player. But I, after that performance, I don't see how you give the ball to anybody else, frankly.
No. And this is no disrespect to the Williams brothers or Jazz Patterson, but none of them have looked capable, like just even capable of what Caleb did in that game.
Yes.
And again, a true freshman. So
a true freshman.
When I say it's all up from here, I'm not saying that it's going to be 200 plus in every single game. You know, like,
I am.
That's not what I mean.
I'm saying that.
Okay.
This is the new floor.
As long as it's you and not me, great. But no, as long as he stays healthy, you know, big games, you know, those big home runs, he's capable of them. You know, how often do they show up? It's, you know, sort of a mystery, but he's a guy that's going to thrive in that system and just keep thriving.
Now, you've got a background in offensive line that I don't. You've always been more astute in how this is graded and how it's determined. I think that frequently fans look at offensive line as a results-oriented operation because it's hard to know what the process really looks like. You know, if you're running the ball well, then the line must be blocking. If you're not running the ball well, then the line must not. If the quarterback's upright, then you must be pass protecting well. If the quarterback keeps getting sacked, it must be a problem for the line. This line was objectively terrible until 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, and it's really amazing because you don't normally see the light come on for a five-man unit that suddenly and in the middle of a season.
And that uniformly, right? And I don't, Is it as simple as just getting some confidence because the Northwestern game went so well? I know they've changed the personnel, particularly they brought back Dickensian character Jack Plum at tackle. But Plum has never been like the book on Plum for years has been he's serviceable at best and he's always waiting to get passed by somebody, you know. It's hard to believe that a fifth-year senior is going to have the light suddenly come on halfway through his last season on campus. And yet, they seem to be markedly better at everything. Petrus is getting more time, which has led to a better completion percentage for Petrus, more throws downfield. Obviously, the running game has come alive as a result of that, and maybe the running game then begets the passing game and vice versa. But is there anything that you're observing in watching the line itself that looks fundamentally different, or is this just a question of, as you said, the light coming on for essentially a five-man unit of undergraduates or underclassmen halfway through a particularly weird offensive season?
Yeah, you know, there's definitely a lot of factors that go into that. Moving Colby to left guard.
I thought for a second you were going to go into a Board High School student there for a second. There are many factors.
I mean, well,
I'm sorry to cut you off. I just had to get that joke.
He'd be a great offensive line coach. Don't get me wrong. But just a move like that, if he's more comfortable there, and especially if he is more comfortable working in conjunction with his teammates, which is a big part of offensive line play, not only in block recognition, but, you know, combo blocks. You know, I really prefer to, you know, refer to them as a unit unless there's one glaring breakdown in a play, and We did see a few of those from Colby. We did see a few of those from Stevens this year. But the way they've got it arranged and the way that these guys are playing off of each other, they do not look like the same line that we were watching a month ago. It's remarkable. And again, I can't remember the last time I've seen a turnaround this quick and this severe, really. Because like you said, they looked bad and it didn't look like they were improving. Because they had looked bad, the guys that came back also looked underwhelming last season too.
Right.
So the fact that we didn't see that light come on for them in the 9 months, or I guess, in the 9 months between seasons, the alarms were going off because they should have gone off. The pessimism was there because it should have been there. And, you heard me a few times say, Kirk has some benefit of the doubt on this. Kirk has some benefit of the doubt on this. But it was sort of turning into a mantra without a whole lot to back it up. And the fact that they have arranged this unit in a way that makes sense going, left to right, basically, is something that just basically changes the trajectory of the offense, changes the trajectory of the season. Like we're not having any of the what if they miss a bowl conversations anymore. Those are, they still technically might, but they have three chances to win a game to become bowl eligible, and I don't think that they're going to miss on all three of them because now they are not at such a disadvantage in terms of everything that you want to do with an offense. And let's also point out, they're not going up against elite defenses on a weekly basis the way they were in the first half of the season.
Yeah.
Like it's,
I think,
look, Northwestern has a couple good guys. Purdue has a couple good guys, but Purdue's not even as good as they've been in the last couple of years.
That's a liberal interpretation of good guys. Yeah. Yeah, there's not Kurloftis or Ryan Kerrigan or somebody out there that's going to
right. No, Kawan Short. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So that's a big part of it too, and something that we shouldn't overlook. But you look at who's on the table for the rest of the season. Wisconsin, always tough. Minnesota, do they have that elite front power? Not elite. I think there's some. They're going to compete with Iowa, but Iowa's going to compete with them too. And Nebraska just isn't there. So I think that what you see here is sustainable for what's left on the docket. Is it something to be, let's say things go well in Iowa, heads into bowl season with, 6-7 wins. Let's say they do enough to get to a bowl against a Power 5 team. That is already sort of rolling the dice again on how good the competition is going to be that they're going to face. So, there's still at the very least, it looks like the rest of the regular season for the green shoots that we see popping up for the first time,
yeah.
It looks like we're going to be able to sustain that growth that we've seen so far. Fingers crossed anyway. Because Wisconsin's got a good defense, but let's also point out that as long as Jim Leonard's there, that the firing of Paul Christ isn't going to change the things that Wisconsin has figured out about Iowa's offense, right? So this weekend might still be a little bit rough, but I don't think that we're going to see a reason to expect a permanent backslide into what had been wrong with this team in the first half of the season. Fingers crossed.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. And frankly, I think you're even seeing some improvement on the defensive side of the ball, as hard as it is to imagine that. But I think you make a valid point as far as the offense goes. You go back and you look at the games that they lost. And look, the Ohio State game was a disaster. On offense, don't get me wrong, but
absolutely, yeah,
But Ohio State was also is also an elite defense. They're elite everywhere. They're Ohio State, sure. Right?
Michigan Jim Knowles is running that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Michigan is pretty much their equal, at least as defense goes. I think they probably are lacking a little bit on the offensive side of the ball, but defensively they've got dudes that are you're going to have to deal with. Illinois has been statistically one of the best defenses in the country all year long. And while Iowa State hasn't necessarily blown the doors off this year, it hasn't been a defensive issue for them for the most part. It's not to excuse scoring 7 points against South Dakota State, right? Or, you know, the kind of, you know, quasi disaster early on against Nevada before the game got essentially rained on and stopped and then restarted and stopped and restarted again. But in hindsight, yes, the competition was better in at least a couple of those games than I think we probably thought. Yes, they were developing the line, and we may have been jumping the gun a little bit on how that actually operates, given the difficulties of building an entire line essentially from scratch, especially when a lot of these guys weren't necessarily the starters going into the year. And then the Iowa offense just simply operates exponentially better if the run game is effective. If you can't run the ball, it's really hard for them to make this work. And they just don't have the capability to essentially adjust it to make it a pass first offense anymore. This isn't 2004 anymore. Like they can't just kind of throw the run game out and just build the thing off of the throw. So,
And which is a problem, right? That is still something that, you know, when we look back on the season in hindsight, I think it's going to be fair to say, okay, why didn't we really implement a real passing game? Because I don't think, well, the line wasn't good enough, and well, the wide receivers were dinged up, and there's going to be some excuses, but it looked like they were sticking to a system that was going to work better with different personnel and just waiting for that personnel to be able to fill in. And when we look back and we're like, oh, so that's why this started 3-4. Yeah, I mean, that's a big, big part of it. The fact that you're facing four top 10 defenses does not help, right? Yeah. And I think that they're going to have – we're already starting to be able to, like, retroactively give them a little bit of grace for that. But two of those games were eminently winnable. The Iowa State game and Illinois game were super winnable. Let's write off Michigan and Ohio State. Sure. Like, well, you know, Niall Kinnett could have come back and not helped them on that one bit. But
yeah.
But no. Those were two winnable games that even a mildly functioning offense would have won. And if you look at that very, like, slightly different hypothetical where Iowa's all of a sudden 7-2 and 4-2 in the division with a head up on Illinois. That's the meat left on the bone. And that's the second straight year of that. And that is a real, real downside for making the suddenly proto-viable case that Brian Ferentz hasn't been the problem. Yeah, he has.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. Who had the best day on Saturday? Out of these three. I'm going to give you three guys. Right. Yeah. Iowa offensive coordinator Brian Ferentz. Mm-hmm. Iowa offensive line coach George Barnett.
Mm-hmm.
Or the man who went full Kill Bill on Twitter afterwards, Iowa wide receivers coach Kelton Copeland.
It had to feel really, really good.
Yeah. I mean, and look, I, you know, there's a clip that went around quite a bit during that game among the Iowa folks of Jack Campbell instructing Cooper DeJean not to help Charlie Jones up after he got knocked on his ass. Like,
there was, and look,
with all that said, there was also plenty of clips after the game of everybody coming over and giving Charlie a hug and, you know, understood, no offense, all that stuff, yada, yada, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that had to feel really good for Kelton Copeland.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And especially in a season where, you know, injuries can be sort of an excuse at times. Next man in, yada, yada, yada. But, I mean, they were starting Bruce, Brody Brecht, and walk-ons in week one. And they weren't prepared for that. They still, like, we haven't gotten virtually anything out of Keegan Johnson this year. Yes. And he was going to be, like, the focal point, along with Laporta, of the passing offense. Now they've got, at the very least, they've got Deontay Vines, who, speaking of guys who rocketed into the starting lineup in the two deeps, there he is.
There he is.
Bruce is back in a role that better suits him than trying to be a number one. They still trust Reganey. They still get production out of Reganey. And that touchdown that he scored was, you know, one of those two or three flashes of game where you're like, oh, that's why that guy gets oh, that's why it's worth it. Because it was, like, it was a great play. So all of a sudden, like, it's really remarkable how much the direction of the season changed with Iowa throttling Purdue rather than, you know, what was expected, which was a 7-point loss, which was, you know, another, you know, the eighth straight game where they give up 20 plus to Purdue, which is probably the longest running streak against any Big Ten opponent, right? But before Iowa snapped it this weekend.
Aside from maybe Ohio State.
I don't know, 33-7 in 2004, and they haven't played them a whole lot.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Yeah, you might be right then.
So it was easy to expect, and in logical, easy, rational to expect the sort of game that would make it look like, oh yeah, this team doesn't have the juice this year. And instead, they just played their best game of the season, with room to clear their best of the season. And now all of a sudden, it looks like things are starting to sort themselves back into place, which has always sort of been the Kirk way, right?
Yeah, and they desperately needed a game like this, right? I heard from a lot of, you know, I won't even say casual, I'd say relatively rabid Iowa fans in the last few weeks about how much they really, really wanted Purdue, which,
yeah,
our jokes aside about them being our most hated rival does not normally happen, right? But after losing, what, 3 out of 4 and all the nonsense with the transfers that happened over the offseason, there was a certain palpable sense of, we kind of need some revenge on these guys this time around. And so I think that getting a win like that against that team is going to placate the fan base more than certainly more than the Northwestern game will, certainly more than the other wins they've had so far this season.
Oh, easily. If the Northwestern game had been 80-0, that Purdue win still would have placated them more.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially because it was the first time all year that they were, you know, a decided underdog and just go out and just win it. I mean, it was a comfortable win. You could essentially take the fourth quarter off, which, again, how often has that happened this year? Yes. Yeah. So I think there's a certain amount that goes in. Now, that all goes out the window if they go 1-2 in the next 3 weeks.
Which is plausible.
It's certainly plausible. Minnesota's back on their shit, right? I mean, they're healthy again. PJ, for all of his, you know, tomfoolery, is really, you know, a run the ball, play action pass guy. And that's what they're going to come in and try to do. Wisconsin seems to be finding their footing with Leonard. Although I'll still say Mertz is not good. Defensively, they've not been great though this year. They've not been as good as they normally are in the past.
Still good, but
still very good.
Yeah,
they look a lot like Iowa State, honestly, when you look at the statistical profile. Yeah. Is like, it's the offense that doesn't really know what the hell they're doing. The defense is just good enough to keep them in games, and they try to win some stuff at the end, but not the great, you know, cavernous disparity between the Iowa offense and Iowa defense for the first half of the season. but still a pretty significant difference there. And I think you're right. I think Nebraska is slowly starting to come to terms with the fact that this season is yet another loss, and that by the time that we hit Black Friday, that they might be ready to fold it up. But even with that said, if we walk out of the season with just one of four trophies, that's not going to sit well with fans. And
it shouldn't.
And it shouldn't, which then leads to my next question. What odds do you put on the idea right now of Brian Ferentz still being the offensive coordinator for 2023? Knowing everything you know about this program, knowing everything you know about the head coach and everything you know about the feckless athletic director who's supposed to be in charge of it all. I still think it's honestly, better than even that he ends up back here next year.
I would have said even going into the Purdue game. So yes. Yeah, I think it's better than even now too, which is a little bit frightening. But if the results start to be there to back it up, then, you know, all of a sudden it's no longer an evidence-based it's not as much of an evidence-based argument as it was, after the Ohio State game. And that also sort of speaks to where we are in this debate, because there's a whole lot of fans and a whole lot of people listening to this podcast included, and I don't think it's incorrect, but there's a whole lot of fans who take Brian's continued role as offensive coordinator personally. And they take it emotionally. And like, it is no longer a, you know, unless they drop 50 a game from here on out, there's so many fans who are completely checked out on the idea of seeing him on the sideline for Iowa. Again, just point blank, end of discussion. Like, there's checked out on him as Nebraska boosters were with Frost after the Georgia Southern game, to the point where, like, I don't even want to see you try to beat Oklahoma. Done trying to win this back with me. I'm so sick of you that we're going to find another $7.5 million just to put in your pocket to get the hell out of here. And that is the level of frustration that Iowa fans have had with Brian for, oh gosh, a season and a half at this point. So
probably longer than that.
Well, but certainly con gusto. I think he got a little bit of a pass, and deservedly so, in 2020. But now, like, some bridges you're not going to be able to build back over the course of 3 weeks or 4 weeks if you want to, you know, backdate it to Purdue. And I think that that's where Brian is with a lot of people. But I don't think Kirk or Gary are two of those people.
I think Kirk in particular,
I am really not sure how much he wants to be around if this is too radioactive for his kid to be there with him. And it wouldn't surprise me if that's sort of part of the argument that he makes with Gary when he gets to tell Gary how to do his job, is to say, you know, I'm not going to make this fun for you if you don't make this all right for my kid. It seems like that's been the case already. Well, right? I'm not talking about a new dynamic.
How much could Gary really do to make it okay for Brian, though? I mean, he could keep him in the job, right? I mean, he could say basically, I'm not going to put the pressure on him. Kirk can keep whoever he wants as offensive coordinator. I support him all the way, which is what he's been doing all along anyway, right? I don't think you're ever going to see a mass exodus of fans from buying tickets. I just don't. I mean, it's not like last year's offense was setting the world on fire and they sold every damn seat to that place 4 months out. I don't think people are going to vote with their pocketbooks, and that's all that really matters to Iowa anyway. And I don't see where there's a leverage point with Kirk otherwise. Yeah. I just don't like Kirk's going to say, or what if I want to keep him here, I get to keep him here. It's my prerogative to keep that guy there. And there's just no other, like as much as I want to, you know, strangle Barta on this one, I think that's right. I don't think there's anything he can do about it. If that's what Kirk wants to do, that's what Kirk gets to do. And we certainly, you're not going to find the money to fire Kirk, obviously.
No, didn't you
and there's no grounds for that.
Didn't you hear Pat McAfee talking about the deep pockets of the farmers in Iowa?
Like, oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they got $42 million to throw at a coach that they've loved for 25 years to get him out of here. Like, it ain't happening.
Yeah.
And
yeah, Case IH is going to throw eight figures at this one. Bud and Mary.
I mean, yeah, they're going to lose that red zone sponsorship that never gets used. I mean, like, what are you going to do? Right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And even if the fans were, let's say that they sold 80% of the tickets next year instead of the full 100. A,
yes,
their 20 will probably get sold, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And B, as long as you can put, you know, something close to full numbers in there, it doesn't matter that much because there's so much money on the TV side that they can get by. So,
yeah.
The money side is not going to change. There's going to be a lot of heat, but so what? Right? We'll just absorb the heat. I would say I would not be surprised if there's a new, you know, sort of quarterback coach or pass game coordinator or something that they want to bring in to essentially take some of the heat off. But
I think we're about to say the same thing. That's sort of like appointing a new captain of a Titanic as it's going down, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like at the end of the day, that coordinator is only going to do what Kirk tells him to do.
We both know that. And if you're going to do that, that means you have to move somebody off staff. I mean, you have a full staff now. And again, Kirk doesn't fire people. Like, he just doesn't. There's not a performance-related firing in 20 years. So I don't see where that's going to be the case. I think it's better than even money right now that Brian Ferentz is back next year, which is staggering from where we were 3 weeks ago.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Like, staggering from where we were 3 weeks ago.
Like, everybody was speculating openly in public on national media. Oh yeah, he's going to the NFL. It was
a fait accompli at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, I think that is still the most beneficial path for him. Right. I don't think he is best served as a coach. I don't think he grows as a coach here in Iowa City. I really don't. And I think that the way that he wants to call an offense, the amount of complexity that he enjoys having in, you know, certain calls and in what he expects out of certain players, I think you have a better chance of having players and having a team that understands those complexities. I think you have a much better chance of getting that from pro players than you do in, especially in a, quote, developmental program. I mean, I'm sorry, but you can't say, yeah, it's going to take you 2 years to learn my playbook in college these days. This is a sport where if you can't, you know, if you get some five-star QB, he better be able to be on that field by week six, his true freshman year. That's the level of expectation. That is the amount of patience that most fan bases have with incoming/transfer QBs. And I mean, like, and there is reason to have these expectations. Look at what Caleb Williams has done at USC. Look at what Michael Penix has done at Washington. He's boat racing the Pac-12. And we're talking about a guy who was a poor fit and a, you know, mildly productive QB at Indiana, especially his last season trying to start. He could barely hang on to that starting job. And he gets into a situation where it's a good fit between him and the coordinator. And straight off the bat, he is super productive. And it is not out of line to want that same level of, or at the very least, to want your offense to be onboarded that quickly by a quarterback, especially an impact quarterback. Because, look, I know what Kirk's trying to do, and I know that he's got results to show for it. But at the end of the day, if you can't bring in a guy who can make an impact, you're just sort of dooming yourself to more 3 and 4 starts if things don't go perfectly, or if, you know, you're down two receivers in a in an offensive lineman. Like, if that's all it takes to submarine your offense for literally the first half of the season, including your sacrifices, that's, I mean, that's untenable.
Yes. Agreed. So, 3 weeks to go, and everything on the table, as far as I'm concerned.
Pretty close, yeah.
I mean, look, if they go 3 for 3, and by the way, tomorrow, as of tomorrow, it'll be tomorrow's the 30th anniversary of the last time they lost a game in November. It'll be since 2019.
That's
Wisconsin,
amazing.
That they lost a November football game. If they keep that streak going until 2023. There's going to be a lot of, I told you so. There's going to be a lot of
sure.
Stay the course, and rightfully so at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, like, we've made this case, Kirk has given reason to, and has earned that benefit of the doubt. Yes. Even though the first 7 weeks of the season, you're like, yeah, but this is different. Yeah. Cause it, for the first 7 weeks, it was different. And then suddenly it wasn't.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But
well, yeah, we're going to get a lot of that. You bet.
We're going to get a lot of that. And well, and look, it could all, again, it could all go up in smoke the next 3 weeks too. But these 3 weeks, by the way, these three games, say what you will about Purdue and Northwestern and Illinois. And I've lived in one of the few pockets of Iowa where Illinois is a real serious thing, right?
Yeah.
You go to Davenport, Burlington, you know, even down to, like, you know, the Fort Madison, Keokuk area, like, the Illinois rivalry is real there, but in very few places outside of there, you know?
Yeah.
The Northwestern thing and the Purdue thing, those are annoyances and frustrations, but they're not full on historical rivalries with all of the, you know, the sort of just pure unadulterated hate that comes along with these other three. These are the three most important games of the year, other than Iowa State, for most of the normal fans. You get them in November. You get them when you're on
the
upswing.
Hardware's there.
Yep. Yeah. And you got every incentive to go out there and win all three, put all of this to bed, finish with a very respectable 9-4 record. Potentially, if Illinois goes, you know, belly up, could, I mean, shockingly win the West. And then,
which would be jaw-dropping. But at the same time, just like last season, they would have earned it.
Yes.
If Illinois goes belly up, that's on them. And
right.
If they close out the season with 5 straight wins against division opponents, including their big 3 trophy games in the Big Ten West, you can't accuse them of not earning it at that point. So,
yeah. No,
absolutely,
exactly.
Everything's on the table. And honestly, I really kind of love finishing out the season with 3 straight trophy games. Like, I want them to do that every year, basically.
Oh,
like, I love this, that this is crunch time.
Yes, the quadrangle of hate is the final 3 is perfect. Like, that's the way it should be.
Yes,
they should. When the Big Ten gets rid of divisions, and we have to, you know, and Ohio State and Michigan assert their, you know, their need to play the last game of the season against each other, and, you know, Indiana and Purdue get that right, and, you know, that's all well and good. I want not just these 3 games, but I want these 3 games among the 4 of us for the last 3 games of every season. Like, that's
absolutely
the way it should be.
Hard agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is cool. This is fun. Like, there's so much at stake right now. Up to and including, let's be clear, that also includes Iowa's trophy case being emptied out in one fell swoop.
No, we could go back to the thing where we're writing about how Kirk's putting his collection of model Oldsmobiles in the trophy case. Like, that could happen in the next 3 weeks, theoretically.
Totally.
And if it does, all hell breaks
loose.
So yes, let's have some fun with the last 3 weeks of the season. Again, as you mentioned, I think the idea of a complete bowl miss is pretty unlikely at this point. So it will go on for a little bit longer, which would be great. But at the very least, we get 3 weeks of pure unadulterated hate with, as you said, hardware on the line. and a whole lot more than that. And this should be fun with Iowa reaching its peak, which again should make it even more entertaining.
Yeah.
Did you watch Hoops last night?
Oh, I did. I did. And
did you get whiplash from the no offense to the nothing but offense nature of the switch from football to basketball season?
Well, they did play a little bit of defense this year, and it's really nice that no disrespect to Jordan Bohannon, but all of a sudden there isn't somebody on that team, especially in that backcourt, where you just seek him out because you know you're going to be able to beat him on dribble drives 80% of the time. Like, yeah. this is a different defensive profile by leaps and bounds, and it starts in the backcourt, starts with Tony Perkins, because oh boy, that guy loves playing great. Like, I wish I had as much fun doing anything as he has playing basketball. Truly.
Yeah, he's going to be fun. He was fun last year. He's going to be a riot this year.
This team
looks really interesting. It like tons of parts, mm-hmm. tons of guys who have real true talent, especially as pure shooters everywhere. Peyton Sanford looks like he's actually like fully ready to go as a starter. Felipe Obrachev.
He's in a perfect situation.
Oh, Sanford. Yes. Yes.
My goodness.
Felipe Obrachev finally, I think, has found the offense. It isn't just kind of a role player. And then, of course, Murray, McCaffrey, Perkins. That's a pretty good core for a decent run in the Big Ten. Plus, there's room for growth with all those guys. It should be a really interesting season for Fran's boys. They're already 20th in KenPom. They were 16th in one of the preseason polls I saw, which is, it's staggering given that they were 7th in the Big Ten media poll. everywhere else they're basically like 2nd or 3rd in the conference. I don't know who's voting on the Big Ten media poll, but they hate them from Iowa.
Well, that is sort of, I think that takes into account their first round exit from the tournament a little bit too much.
Yeah, probably.
But at the end of the day, like, when Vegas comes out and says Iowa has the 2nd best odds of winning the conference behind Indiana, one, I think you were the one that said this before. One, it tells you a whole lot about the Big Ten this year. But two, like, it tells you that the people who like make money off this and specifically make money off being right about these sorts of things, if they see room for optimism and they see room for, putting together 14, 15 conference wins, it's certainly something worth listening to. It's not a guarantee, but it's worth listening to.
Yep.
And the fact that we're going to see yet another, like, totally different build of what this team does, because Fran used to be a defense first coach. This used to be Aaron White's like rowdy rumble tumble, basketball fun. And then it was like, oh, now we've got Peter Jock, let's bomb. And then it was, run everything through Garza. And now it's getting as close to positionless basketball as we've ever seen Iowa. And that's going to be fun and irritating for the rest of the Big Ten, because there's so many different units you can throw out there and have them be viable this year. So many.
They're gonna be able to mix and match in ways they haven't. I mean, they did a little bit last year, especially second half of last year. But you're gonna see a lot more of adjusting to what the opponent's able to throw at them and having the piece to put in there to fix it, I think, than you've ever seen from Iowa, which is, I mean, look, I'm the king of mocking our athletic director, and I will continue to be that guy. But the on-field, on-court stuff, aside from a few hiccups with football early on this year, really seems to be on the up and up across the board. I mean, women's basketball's as good as it's been since, the Vivian Stringer days. The men's team is interesting and fun and great to watch. The wrestling program seems to be, mostly resurrected. Like, the things that the touchstones that we look for outside of football are all trending extremely high right now. And it's a great time to be an Iowa fan, just in general, putting aside how awful it is to watch Iowa's offense sometimes.
And I think Fran is in another sort of instance of him adapting and growing as coach. I think he's a great ambassador for the athletic program now. And, you know, those first couple of years, it was all about, you know, the rage of Fran and, you know, red-faced Fran and all and this and that. And he's still capable of that. But he is, I think he is much more comfortable now. And maybe it's because his kids are on the team. But, you know, I think his dominant personality now isn't, you know, I want to rip the ref's trachea out. It is, I want to talk basketball for the next 15 minutes. Give me one question and I'll give you a like this long, like ball nerd answer. And I think that's great. Yes. And the fact that it translates so well to the way that he coaches these guys, which is, no, your light's going to stay green. No, you know, I'm not yelling at you. Yep. I'm not trying to like
go
psych you
just
out.
Just go. And, yeah.
Yeah. And that is, especially after those, you know, Franuary swoons that we got when that team, you know, when those teams, you know, would reach the top 10 and sometimes even the top five and then sort of peter out over the course of the year. I think he learned a few lessons in terms of keeping his guys motivated and focused and confident. He mentions confidence a lot these days. And I think it's paying dividends. And I think the, you know, getting over the hump in terms of a deep NCAA run, or at the very least, it's, you know, a Sweet 16 run. He's had bad luck on that front. I think he's going to, you know, they're going to keep having decent chances at breaking that run of bad luck over the next few years. I think they're set up super well now and in the future. And a big part of that is Fran's growth as a coach and as, you know, a leader of the program. I think it's great.
Agreed. It's going to be a fun year. It's going to be
absolutely
with expectations where they are. It's going to be a fun year. And that's,
that's all you can ask for.
That's all you can ask for. And we'll be here for it. At least in theory. all right. Well, we've been going about 50 minutes. It is election night. So we're going to get back to, you know, probably, you know, drinking copiously. Pat Vint, Adam Jacoby. Thanks for listening. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast apps. Potting is winning. Anyway, thanks again for listening. We'll be back with you next week.